Is It Rolling Bob?
Talking Dylan.
He's your host, Lucas Hare.
He's your host, Kerry Shale.
But on the digital Bob phone from Lancashire, he's our guest, playwright and screenwriter, Dara Carville.
Then she says, I know you're an artist. Draw a picture of me. I said, I would if I could, but I don't draw sketches from memory. Well, she says, I'm right here in front of you, or haven't you looked? I said, all right, I know it, but I don't have my drawing book. She gives me a napkin. She says, you can do it on that. I say, yes, I could, but I don't know where my pencil is at. She pulls one out from behind her ear. She says, all right, now, go ahead, draw me. I'm standing right here. I make a few lines, and I show it to her to see. Well, she takes the napkin and throws it back and says, that don't look a thing like me. I said, oh, kind miss, it most certainly does. She says, you must be joking. I say, I wish I was.
Fabulous. I love Highlands. That's just, and I love I Don't Know Where My Pencil Is At. That's one of the few lines that made me laugh out loud in a Dylan song. Why did you choose that, Darren?
Well, that's one of the reasons, really, because it makes me laugh. And I think Dylan's funniness is something that is often overlooked, just how funny he is as a writer, his sort of comic timing, which has been there really right from the beginning. I mean, it fades sometimes. There are periods where the work is kind of darker, but it's always lovely when that sense of humor comes back. So, I mean, that little passage, it does kind of, a lot of the things that I most love in Dylan, it's got his amazing ear for dialogue, that sort of vernacular language. And it's got that kind of dramatic quality that his writing very often has, that storytelling quality where we go in to a scene between two quite clearly defined characters having this kind of moment of engagement and drama and conflict. So I loved all of that. It's something that I really respond to in Dylan's work, but there's also a kind of personal reason for it. I was one of those people, I guess, like you guys, who was with Dylan through the long, dark years of the 80s, or I sort of became a fan of Dylan in the early 80s. And I was discovering the riches, the treasure trove of the back catalogue at the same time as the new work that was coming out, the Empire Burlesques and so on, were so poor in comparison. Mm. And there was a sort of sense of him as an embarrassment. I mean, it's strange to think now, but there was. It was slightly embarrassing to be a Bob Dylan fan. Mm. And I always knew that there was going to be a revival. I knew at some point the record will come out that everybody will go, wow, he's back, this is amazing. Because that had started to happen. I mean, Dylan wasn't the only artist of the 60s who had a difficult 80s. I mean, it happened almost to everyone. Mm. But it had started towards the end of the 80s. There's a pattern had developed where artists who had been written off were coming back with great work. You know, it happened with Lou Reed. It happened with Neil Young. When we get into the 90s, it was happening with, you know, McCartney. And there was this kind of thing happening where the new work would come along that would remind you of the glories of the old work, and there'd be a new chapter. And I kept waiting for that to happen with Dylan. Mm. And it sort of almost did with Oh Mercy. And there are great things on Oh Mercy. And obviously the early 90s albums of folk songs have their admirers, and there are things to love in those records. But it was really with Time Out of Mind, and specifically, I think, with Highlands, that I remember listening to it for the first time. And when it comes to that scene, and it's the last song on the record, obviously, and when it comes to that scene between the narrator and the waitress, as you say, Kerry, it just made me laugh out loud. And there was an enormous sense of relief, almost, that the kind of alertness and intelligence of the Dylan of the 60s and 70s was suddenly back. Not Dark Yet as well on that record was the other one that, I mean, at the time, for me, I must have been really annoying, because I literally remember phoning people up and playing them these songs over the phone, because I was so excited that that this great artist was back on form.
It's so funny how we accept now that Time Out of Mind is this major work, and I think rightly. But I remember sitting at the same desk I'm sitting at now, listening to it for maybe the second or third time, just having it on while I was working, and listening to the lines, "I've been to London and I've been to gay Paris. I followed the river and I got to the sea." And I thought, what is this nonsense? You know, in a similar way that we were saying with Rufus Jones about some of the couplets in Murder Most Foul, they just make your toes curl. But now, it's no problem at all. I mean, it doesn't sound trite at all.
Absolutely. But also, this is a thing I'm interested in about Dylan. The fact that as fans, as people who love this work, you kind of have to take the rough with the smooth. You know, you kind of, I think part of what many Dylan people love is the kind of lack of polish, the lack of finish, the kind of slightly rough quality of the work compared to, you know, a Paul Simon or someone whose work is much more polished. Mm. And the unpredictability of his work and the range of his work. And so it's kind of almost, it feels almost churlish of us to kind of pick out things that don't work, because the things that don't work are part of the roughness of the whole sort of the whole body of work. And there are things there are moments in the whole across the career that just make me cringe. Mm. But because I'm in love with this work, that's part of the love in a strange way, in the way that it is in an actual, you know, in a marriage, when you're deeply in love with someone, it's not that you're blind to the flaws. You kind of love those too. Dylan's very good on this, actually, in his love songs. I was listening to Wedding Song yesterday, and it's the most complicated, mixed up message, that song. I mean, it's very far from being a straightforward love song. It's about kind of obsession and, you know, all of the kind of problems of a relationship. That's all in there. He's rarely kind of one, you know, one clear note.
I think he tests everyone. He tests the waitress in Highlands, and he tests us by, I think, sometimes the doggerel that he throws in the middle of some otherwise beautiful and complex lyric could just be a test. I'm just going to throw this at you. Mm. You know, some really, what seems like really easy, shitty, you know, lazy writing. Well, that makes you cringe.
What's that song is it in Ain't Talking on Modern Times when he pronounces superfluous? And you think the effort you've gone to pronounce that incorrectly, to make it scan that way, when you could quite easily just say it properly, but you can almost see the glint in his eye that says, go on, have a go at me, go on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there is something obstinate about his personality that really comes across, where you kind of think, I mean, certainly in recent years, when his voice has become this incredibly gravelly, damaged thing, and you just sometimes think, God, can you just clear your throat before before you sing this song? Could you just, you know, clear your throat? And there's clearly this obstinacy in him, this orneriness that refuses to do that, that refuses to please. There's, you know, that's always something with Dylan. He's never trying to kind of win you over or make you like him in the work.
Absolutely. Well, in Highlands, going back to that, I remember the first time I heard it, and I heard the line, "You don't read women authors, do you?"
Yeah.
And then he says, at least that's what I think I heard her say, because you can't believe that that character in a song is saying that. You don't read women authors, do you? That's certainly never been written in a song before.
No, I mean, you know, you can never take these things literally with Dylan, but there's something so odd about that it feels true to me. It feels that, to me, like that encounter happened, or some kind of encounter like that, and that this was a question that was thrown at him, and that sort of threw him in the moment. I was reading an essay about what touches on this song, an essay by Aidan Day in that collection that Neil Corcoran edited. It's called Do You, Mr. Jones? And he sort of reads this encounter in the cafe in Highlands as having a kind of, that there's a kind of almost sort of sexual menace to it, as if the narrator is kind of, well, he sort of presents a vision of the narrator as kind of sleazy, which was never how I saw it. For me, this is connected to the bigger theme of that record and the bigger theme of that song, which is about this aging narrator lost in the world, looking at young people and not being able to connect with them, but sort of envying them. And for me, that's kind of, there's something around that going on in this odd encounter. I never thought that, you know, he was coming on to her or something.
Oh, no, I think it's the opposite of that. I think it's this, you know, when he says, tell me what I want, and she says, you probably want hard-boiled eggs, another line that made me laugh out loud. Because it seems to me that hard-boiled eggs are like, you know, your balls have slipped or something to do with sexual inadequacy, not, you know, just something with aging again.
Also because it rhymes with long, white, shiny legs.
True. Yeah. True. But there's something about hard-boiled eggs. It's just the sound. It sounds funny. No matter what, you know, it's not a metaphor or anything. It's just, I know that I think the Marx Brothers used hard-boiled eggs as a punchline in a movie. I think they were calling down to room service, send me up a room. And I know that they kept out ordering hard-boiled eggs. It was just, maybe it was a vaudeville joke. I don't know.
There's also the hard-boiled detective genre, you know, and there's this kind of, because it has this, that initial bit of that conversation has this sort of movie dialogue kind of hard-boiled edge to it. And then it sort of, it keeps sort of tripping over itself as it gets awkward. And that thing you mentioned, Dara, about, you know, at least that's what I think I say. There is maybe another parallel universe in which that's not what she said. And the conversation goes on anyway. And it was awkward enough in the first place. And now it's really awkward because she never even said that in the first place. Is there room for it all, I think?
No, absolutely. And the sort of film noirish quality of the dialogue there, I think that's a really good point. And it's clearly something that Dylan's constantly drawn to. But different kind of genres of storytelling, there's obviously there are a lot of, I mean, it's curious, there are a lot of Western songs in his canon, and there are comedy songs. And, you know, he does seem to be a writer who ranges across lots and lots of different genres. But film noir is certainly a big part of it. And it almost feels like in the last 20 years or so that his whole persona is becoming, you know, like a sort of Humphrey Bogart quality, that sort of raspy voice and those narrowed eyes. His whole demeanor is becoming quite film noirish, and a riverboat gambler thrown in as well.
Yeah. I mean, look at him in the video for something like Things Have Changed, you know, just the way he's kind of, his eyes are kind of sort of slowly, you know, his eyes were two slits, as the man himself said, you know, he looks like he exists outside culture, and he's kind of cocking a suspicious look at every single person he meets.
That very distinctive sort of squint, that's, you know, it's like Bogart, and it's like,
you know, I just like realized it's a bit like Vincent Price.
Yeah,
you know, that the mustache, you know, the early Vincent Price movies before he was a sort of a horror person. He was a kind of a spivvy sort of guy in a nice suit, you know, so but untrustworthy.
Yeah, I mean, there is this other, oddly or paradoxically, it's one of the constants of Dylan, is this process of reinvention and him becoming different characters, not in a self-consciously theatrical way like Bowie, but in a more sort of organic way, the way, you know, the character who sings the songs on Blonde is a very different character from the one who is on Nashville Skyline, who's different again from Rolling Thunder, and who's very different from the Riverboat Gambler character that we have now. But, you know, they're all him, but it's constantly changing.
Speaking of murder mysteries, what do you make of, I mean, I was listening to Dignity recently, and I hadn't quite seen it until, well, because I knew you were coming on, and the fact that you've written The Bay, the ITV series, and it's a murder mystery of a sort anyway. And I thought, Dignity, I keep forgetting that it's a murder mystery, that somebody got murdered on New Year's Eve, and it seems like the private eye on one level in the song is trying to track him down. But what do you make of the song?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the songs that I keep going back to, and it's a great storytelling song. It's a great genre piece, but it's also wonderfully playful and abstract. So it never kind of, I mean, the difficulty with the storytelling song in some ways is that it can become it can become a bit pat. I mean, this rarely happens with Dylan's. I don't know if it happens with any Dylan story songs, but with other story songs, it's kind of like once you've heard it once and you've heard this story go from beginning, middle to end and be resolved, you kind of feel, okay, I've got it now. I don't need to hear that song again. And the whole point of songs is that you need to hear them again, that they are, it's part of the program of songwriting is to make something that's infinitely repeatable. And with something like Dignity, I can just constantly listen to that because it never really resolves. But at the same time, it's deeply satisfying. It's not like it's just he's making it up as he goes along and it doesn't go anywhere. Although he's perfectly capable of doing that too. And there are songs that are, I mean, in some ways, Dignity maybe is an example of this too. What you might call Shaggy Dog stories, you know, stories that don't really go anywhere, and yet you kind of love being on that journey.
And also, I guess the narrator of Dignity is kind of, there's a couple of layers there, because he's not simply the narrator of the tale. He's almost narrating the narrator, because when he says, I met Prince Philip at the Home of the Blues, and he said he'd give me information if his name wasn't used, well, you've just named him. So it's almost like he's a third party commenting on the action.
And how are you abused by Dignity? Or is it, I mean, the whole idea of what Dignity is also one of the things I think the song is about, because it does make you think that you can be abused by Dignity. I suppose Prince Philip, you know, could, well, actually it's funny because Prince Philip, of course, was always losing his dignity by saying making some racist remark or, you know, just actually cutting, maybe that's, I've only just thought of this now, but Prince Philip would often cut through the royalty thing and just become this, you know, this guy who grew up in this weird way and would say what he actually thought.
And goes to blues bars.
Who goes to blues bars?
I mean, I don't. I've never really thought of that Prince Philip being that Prince Philip.
Right. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, again, clearly this is something Dylan does all the time, is take real life characters and put them in songs. And there is something delicious about the incongruity of a British royal being in the Home of the Blues. But I'd always thought of, like, Prince Philip is, you know, that prince is not a real prince. I guess I thought of him as being like one of those Damon Runyon sort of characters that populate the world of this song.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that reminds me of I watched a bit of Masked and Anonymous the other day, just because it's still a miserably awful, difficult movie to watch. But the character names are fabulous, aren't they? Uncle Sweetheart, Pagan Lace, Bobby Cupid. They're all names of out of Dylan songs that he hasn't written.
And he's brilliant at that. The thing he's not brilliant at is the kind of sustained character writing that is required in a screenplay. It's really interesting, actually, because this is the thing I'm fascinated by, Dylan as storyteller and Dylan as dramatist, I guess. And it's something that he constantly returns to and sort of wrestles with. And it's there from the beginning, from very early songs that are story songs or dramatic songs. And it's there right through. It sort of ebbs and flows and comes into prominence at different times. And so it's clearly something he's fascinated by. We know he draws a lot on cinema. We know that he uses a lot of film dialogue in his songs. And there are, you know, scrupulous scholars who will go and track down every line of dialogue. So he's fascinated by drama and storytelling, particularly cinema. But then when he tries to actually do it, you know, when it's not writing a song, but actually making a movie, whether it's Rinalda and Clara or
Masked and Anonymous,
or even Hearts of Fire. I know he didn't write that, but God help us.
Yeah.
They don't work at all. And I was really interested to come across the other day. I was, sort of reading around this, and I read an interview with Jack Levy, who, as you know, obviously collaborated with Dylan on the songs for Desire. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about Desire is that is a wholesale return of the story song, which had sort of been missing for quite a while. I mean, there are story songs and Blood on the Tracks to some degree, but a real kind of wholehearted commitment to stories with beginning, middle and end comes back on Desire. And Jack Levy literally says, Bob isn't very good at storytelling. I've got the quote here, actually. Let me just find it. He says, give me a sec.
Is it that he's not interested in storytelling? That would be more close. You know, linear stuff seems like it doesn't interest him.
It is very much that. This is what Levy says. Bob is not really that good at telling stories, you know? He doesn't go from A to B to C to D. He's got a lot of good stuff in his songs, but they don't usually add up to a story. Once in a while, they do. So that's what, and that's Levy being interviewed in 2004. But what he's talking about there is the reason why Dylan wanted to work with him, because he came from a playwriting background, a theatre directing background, and he'd worked with McGuinn and the Byrds as a lyricist. Mm. And Dylan makes that odd decision to collaborate with another lyricist rather than a musician. Mm. But it's because of Levy's expertise with story and with being able to, as he say, go from A to B to C to D, you know, to do that kind of structural thinking. And it's something that, I mean, I think you're right. It's that, generally speaking, that isn't something that Dylan is interested in doing.
He may not even be able to do it, I suspect, because I'm just reminded of the Elton John biography. I don't know if you've read it, but it's actually really good. The Elton John thing. Yeah. And he talks about playing charades or charades with Bob Dylan. And he said, Bob can't do it. He can't do it. And in a way, that's what charades is, charades. It's just you tell a story in order to get your point across.
And, I haven't read the whole book, but I've read that section. It's fantastic. I love those little kind of insights into what Bob Dylan is really like. I once met someone who knew Dylan when he was young. I met this brilliant theatre person at a festival in Montreal, Linda Gaborio, she's called, and she had been in Greenwich Village in the early days, and she knew Bob Dylan before he was famous. I mean, he may not have even been Bob Dylan. And she said to me, and I quote, Bob was weird. And, you know, that was before he was famous. He was already quite odd. Mm. And I think that's absolutely key to him. And every time I get a bit frustrated, you know, when you go and see him live, I've seen him a lot, and, you know, he'll do, I don't know, he'll just suddenly start playing the piano like Les Dawson, or, you know, he'll just do something deeply strange. I'm always reminded, well, you know, that's just who Bob is. Bob is weird. And there's a story. Have you read Sam Shepard's book about Rolling Thunder?
Oh, yeah.
There's a moment in that where he talks about taking Dylan to see one of Shepard's plays, and Dylan starts talking from the audience to the characters on stage and saying, you know, oh, no, you can't do that. And, you know, so, and it's almost as if, and Shepard is writing it, and he's sort of kind of clearly quite embarrassed by this. You know, he's brought this guy along to see his play, and he's sort of disrupting it and acting very strangely, as if he's never seen a play before. But whether, you know, the question of whether he can tell a story of the beginning, middle, and end. You know, he does that in the early days on those first records. I mean, a song like Hattie Carroll is a brilliant, brilliant, sustained piece of storytelling. And it really does go from, it has a beginning, a middle, and end. I mean, to quote Godard, not necessarily in that order, but it has all of the elements. It's a perfect piece of storytelling. I mean, it's interesting in that it's not chronological. It isn't beginning, middle, end. It starts with William Zangzinger killed poor Hattie Carroll. So it starts with, in the work of a more conventional writer, that might have been the end point, and they may have told the story of that evening chronologically. Dylan doesn't do that. He starts with the murder, then the arrest, then he flips back to describe what Hattie Carroll herself was like. So it's almost, we go into a kind of flashback. So we start in the middle, we then go to the beginning, and then we come to the end. And the end of the song, of course, is not the murder, but is the sentence. Mm. And that's the point of the song, is the injustice of the sentence that Zantinger gets.
And from his point of view,
perfectly capable of doing that incredibly concentrated kind of storytelling. And there are other, you know, there are numerous other songs early on, mostly true stories, mostly with the civil rights theme, you know, Hollis Brown and so on. Mm. And then he sort of turns against that. And there's that famous story of the argument he had with Phil Ox, where he plays him, "Can you please crawl out your window?" And Phil Ox doesn't like it, and they have a row, and Dylan ends up chucking him out of his taxi. You know this story?
Yes.
And he says, Dylan's quoted as saying to Phil Ox, "You're not a folk singer, you're just a journalist." And the idea of being a journalist, in spite of the fact that Dylan himself had written those very journalistic, you know, true story songs early on, the idea of just being a journalist and just writing about kind of real life is seen as a lesser thing.
I mean, just going back to Hattie Carroll, the interesting thing about that as well is just a little bit of research reveals that it's really not an accurate depiction of what happened. I mean, from the off, he's not called Zantzinger, he's called Zantzinger. The whole thing is Dylan's version of what happened. And he has an objective, which is to tell a story. And when it overlaps with fact, great. But that needn't be the be-all and end-all.
And I mean, you can say absolutely the same thing for Hurricane, which comes then, you know, 10 years later and is the fruit of that collaboration with Levy. And like Hattie Carroll, it's just an absolutely extraordinary piece of songwriting. Yeah. But again, not necessarily accurate, you know, as we know. In fact, they had to recut the song because some of it was considered to be sort of libelously wide of the mark. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And then there's Joey on that record too, which is a sort of tie-in to New York mobster.
Going back to what you were saying, I think Joey, Hurricane, Isis, Black Diamond Bay are all pretty linear story songs. Now, I have no idea how much of that is Dylan and how much of that is Levy. But, you know, I mean, it's been said before, but I'll quote it again, the beginning of Hurricane, if you just take the text and retype it into a screenplay format, it reads, pistol shots ring out in a barroom, full stop, night, full stop, enter, capital letters, Paddy Valentine from the upper hall. She sees a capital letters bartender in a pool of blood, cries out. Then her line is, "My God, they killed them all." You couldn't write that more specifically if you tried, and that may well be Levy. But
yeah, I suspect quite a lot of that is Levy. And just from watching that interview with him, it's up on YouTube, I think quite a lot of Isis as well is... which I sort of found in an odd way faintly disappointing, because he talks about, you know, I love the rhyme of outrageous and what's
contagious.
Outrageous and contagious, yeah. And he actually makes a point of saying how much Dylan loved that rhyme. So that was actually Levy who wrote that. No, I mean, those songs, as I say, they have, and Black Diamond Bay, absolutely, you know, it has a kind of a real conclusion, a real kind of turning point at the end. Those songs are very much structured as stories. And it's really interesting to see him come back to that, because, as I say, with that Phil Ox moment, he had very clearly turned away from linear storytelling in his songwriting. So it's very interesting to see that come back. But there are other kinds of storytelling, obviously, that he was also doing. So, you know, around the same time as Hattie Carroll and that incredibly journalistic, crisp piece of reportage, you know, kind of story torn from the headlines, he's also writing Bob Dylan's 115th Dream, just sort of madcap comedy song, and yet with a kind of, you know, it's not just a comedy song. It's not just meant to make you laugh, although it's very funny. There's something complicated and playful going on there. And those kinds of songs continue. And on John Wesley Harding, it's full of story songs, but they're very much the Shaggy Dog story or the kind of parable. They're not beginning, middle, and end kind of narratives. They're stranger than that. I would sort of feel with John Wesley Harding that's the record where he's going. In a very creative way, he's going, I don't have the answers. because obviously, as we know, he was at that time seen as this extraordinary guru and spokesman of a generation and all of that, and all of that stuff that he was trying to escape. And I think John Wesley Harding is a first attempt to say, no, I don't have, that's not me, I don't have the answers. And then when that didn't quite work, when actually people started to read into that record even more and sort of see the faces of the Beatles on the cover and all of that kind of stuff, then he goes, all right, I'm, you know, and turns around and makes Self-Portrait as really an attempt to kind of shake off those kind of obsessives.
I guess even when he's deliberately and willfully not telling a story, he still is. I mean, I think of two things. One, Clothesline Saga, which is, I mean, it's a parody of Ode to Billy Joe, and it's quite clearly a story, but it willfully ends on, Ma met me, and I went inside and I shut all the doors. But it's delivered with such a kind of deliberate sense of conclusion that it sounds like an ending, even though it's not. And the other thing is, I was watching there's a 90-minute Joni Mitchell documentary on YouTube, which I watched over the weekend. And she said the thing that attracted her to Dylan was the storytelling aspect in his work. And then went on to talk about Positively Fourth Street. And I thought, well, that's not really a storytelling song. But then again, I guess the point is that even when he's not telling a story, he is.
Well, I love Clothesline Saga too. Sorry, just to say that my favorite lines in that are, because right in the middle of this, I think it's kind of a non-story Clothesline Saga. Really, it's just hanging clothes on a line. But then in the middle of it all, it's the vice president's gone mad. Where? Downtown. When? Last night. Oh, say, that's too bad. Mm. That's a story in the middle of this thing about clothes not drying.
Yeah, yeah. No,
and absolutely. I love that too. It's another way of telling stories.
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, I don't think he would ever think of himself as doing this, but he is deconstructing storytelling in a song like that. And I think that's happening across John Wesley Harding and lots of other places where he's taking apart the traditional structure of story so that a song can feel like a story while not adding up to being that kind of satisfying linear narrative. And he's doing it very, very deliberately. Michael Gray writes about Dylan's use of dramatic monologue, and he compares him to Robert Browning. And I think there's something in that. There are a lot of those songs, while they're not necessarily telling a story, they are creating a drama in that they're voiced from the perspective of a distinctive character and they're voiced to another distinctive character. So there is a kind of dramatic dialogue or an implied dialogue going on in something like Positively Fourth Street. Mm. And then there are other... There are other moments just in songs that are not stories where suddenly you'll just get a vivid little passage of story, you know, like a little kind of fragment or shard. Like in Idiot Wind, they say, I shot a man named Gray. That little section is just a brilliant, funny, clever little story that's told within about four lines, and then the song goes on and does lots of other things. And that's something that happens a lot in Dylan as well.
Well, the elephant in the room, I think, is Brownsville.
Yes.
As we mentioned, Sam Shepard. And talk about a story. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that collaboration between Shepard and Dylan is really extraordinary. I'd be very interested to know, and I don't suppose there's any way we will know, who wrote what on that song. I mean, who wrote the line? If there's an original thought out there, I could use it right now. You know, whichever of them did, it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, that it's a wonderful, it's one of my favorite songs, not just Dylan songs, but songs full stop. And it does feel like a story. It feels like an epic movie, and it's obviously also reflecting on movies, and it's kind of spinning off from the Gregory Peck film, The Gunfighter. But it would be hard to paraphrase what that story is. There was talk, I don't know if you remember, there was talk a couple of years ago that they were going to make a film of it. It was in the papers, and it said the one piece of concrete information in the reports was that Brad Pitt was going to play Henry Porter. The only thing we know about Henry Porter is that his name wasn't Henry Porter. Yeah. I think if you made a film of Brownsville Girl, you would end up with something very much like Masked and Anonymous or Rinalda and Clara, as in a complete mess. Yeah. But as a song, it is just superlative.
Well, you know, it should be a complete mess because, you know, if you had Brad Pitt and a linear storyline,
yeah,
it wouldn't be Brownsville Girl.
It would absolutely kill it. It would, yeah.
Also, when you hear a song that's infused with this sort of cinematic quality, some of the money men somewhere are thinking, hey, we'll make this into a film. You know what? Just leave it as a cinematic-esque song. I mean, Highway Patrolman by Bruce Springsteen from Nebraska was turned into a film. Is it The Indian Runner? It's a short film.
Yeah, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and you think, well, look, I love that song, and it's a really good film, but that's unnecessary. It really is unnecessary.
Leave it alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Step away from the song.
Do you have any thoughts, Dara, on the differences between Brownsville Girl and New Danville Girl, or are we getting a little bit too geeky there?
No, God, it's not possible to get too geeky.
You're among friends.
I'll have to put that on the website.
On this stuff. I prefer Brownsville Girl. There's much to love in the original, but I think between the recordings, much is gained. And my understanding is that the work that went on after the recording of the first version, between the recording of the first version and the second, was largely Dylan. Mm. I don't think that was continued collaboration with Sam Shepherd. So it'd be interesting to actually just compare those lyrics, because that may well show us how much of that is Bob. I mean, I love both, but the finished version, the final released version, the fantastic interplay with the backing singers, the sense of real drama, but not just in the lyrics, but in the music. And again, Michael Gray has written brilliantly about this, the way the song is half sung and half spoken, and within a single line, he can shift between singing and speaking. It's extraordinary.
By the way, just as a teeny little addendum, I don't spend much time on Expecting Rain, but I did have a bit of time on my hands. So I looked up Brownsville Girl on Expecting Rain, and somebody had written in to say that they'd been watching an episode of Rawhide, the Clint Eastwood TV series that he made before he was a big star, and there was a character named Henry Porter in it. And the big thing was, who was he? Because the only thing they knew about him was that his name wasn't Henry Porter. Now, I don't know if that's true, but somebody wrote that on Expecting Rain. So
I wouldn't be at all surprised. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that was true.
I did love the bit. You presumably have seen the bit where Gregory Peck pays tribute to Bob by quoting the song.
Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh, my God. It's on YouTube. Oh,
I must check that out.
It's a Kennedy Center award ceremony for Bob. Bob is sitting there next to the Clintons, and he's got this ribbon around his neck. And Gregory Peck comes out and quotes the first, eight lines.
Oh, my God.
A Brownsville Girl. And Dylan appears to be weeping. His eyes soften. It's quite a long shot, but at the end he nods and does a little, not namaste, but does a little sort of thing to Gregory Peck, and it's like his dreams have come true. Gregory Peck is quoting him to himself,
because there is an interview early 70s, I think. I can't remember where it is or where I read it, but he's talking about Gregory Peck. I think he says in that interview, "I would see him in anything," which is then the lyric that comes back in the song. But yeah, I wouldn't, the Rawhide thing, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that was the case, because we know he's got form there of pinching stuff. And I actually, the other day, I'd never seen the movie Shane before. Mm-hmm. And my son, Dan, who's 17, and he's going through a kind of Western phase. Mm. I think largely dictated by, there's a computer game called Red Dead Redemption. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. Mm-hmm. That has a kind of Western setting. And it set him off on a trip through the history of the Western. He's really into Clint Eastwood and stuff. Anyway, we watched Shane. Mm. And there's that line about, "I don't mind leaving. I just want it to be my idea," which Dylan picks up in, I can't remember which song it is, "Sweetheart Like You" or something like that. So he does, we know he does this. Mm-hmm. He pulls lines out of movies. And that, I mean, this is another thing that I'm really interested in, which is Dylan's dialogue. You know, because we talk so much and so much has been written about Dylan as poet and whether he is a poet and whether the words work on the page separate from the music. But this kind of idea of Dylan as a dramatist or Dylan as a storyteller seems much less explored. And for me, it's really key to him because one of the things he's so good at, he's just got an extraordinary ear for spoken language, and it goes right through the songs. And it's also one of the reasons that reading interviews with him is such a pleasure, because the sort of cadences of his spoken language is, you know, it's very close to his lyrics. It was one of the pleasures as well of the radio show was just hearing him talk, and just for me at least, it was kind of an intense pleasure in just the way he uses language. And so I always love when within a song there are fragments of dialogue, and it's something he does a lot. I would say, you know, it's quite unusual, I would have thought, in a songwriter. Mm. And you get these kind of wonderfully vivid moments. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of something like Isis, where you've got that fantastic sort of crescendo. And again, obviously, we don't know how much of this was Bob, how much of this was Jack Levy, but this feels like Dylan to me, that the last verse, the second last verse, where goes, she said, "Where you been?" I said, "No place special." She said, "You look different." I said, "Well, I guess." She said, "You've been gone." I said, "That's only natural." She said, "You're going to stay?" I said, "If you want me to, yes." that yes, yeah. Which just takes off in the song.
Yeah.
It's so thrilling. And I was thinking about that, and I had a look on in the big book of Bob Dylan lyrics. And very frustratingly, that is entirely rewritten in the published lyrics, and it's much less interesting.
Mm. What do they do? What do they do with it?
Hang on, give me a second. I'll just grab it because they
do that on the website as
it's
well.
It's often
don't
the
they?
Case. The, yeah, the officially published lyrics are very often not nearly as interesting as what he sings.
I always wonder if that's a mistake, you know, somebody in the Dylan office being lazy has Bob done it?
No, because you copyright the lyrics presumably at a different time from recording them. And they don't want to go back and recopyright the different set of lyrics, maybe. I don't know.
It's very strange. So in the published lyrics, it goes, the first line's the same. She said, "Where you been?" I said, "No place special." She said, "You look different." I said, "Not quite."
Not quite?
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Like an English vicar.
So much less interesting than "well, I guess." She said, "You've been gone." I said, "That's only natural." She said, "You're going to stay?" I said, "Yeah, I just might." Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's far more like Highlands, isn't it? That kind of, you know, shrugging kind of, maybe, well, you know.
Yeah, it's so much less thrilling than the "if you want me to," yes. Yeah.
I'll tell you one bit of dialogue that I'm always confused by, even though I think it's a great song, which is Frankie Lee and Judas Priest.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me, and now maybe they're supposed to be two halves of the same person, but they talk in the same way, it seems to me. Or I always think, oh, it's Frankie Lee. He's the gambler whose father is deceased, and Judas Priest. But I always get them confused because I think there's something about the syntax about when whoever it is leaves. I'm totally confused whether it's Frankie Lee or Judas Priest. Mm, and whichever one of them dies, I'm always confused which of them has died. And
I'm sure if you're confused by any song on John Wesley Harding, it's entirely deliberate.
Yeah, it is, but I'm because he could, I think, have made the characters more different,
distinctive.
Yeah,
yeah. No, I think he. I mean, I think Lucas is right. It is deliberate, but it's deliberately frustrating.
Yeah,
and I think it is that thing of not wanting to present a finished story. I mean, that song in particular really is a Shaggy Dog story. It doesn't really go anywhere. But it's wonderful. I mean, I absolutely adore it.
Well, nothing is revealed, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Have you ever noticed the similarity between Romance in Durango and El Paso by Marty Robbins?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Give that a listen, because there's a clear influence there. And that, again, is a very Shaggy Dog story with a great Western motif, you know, right down to having the narrator die. And I mean, it's great stuff. It's a fantastic song, but there's a clear influence there too.
I'll check that out. Other just little glimpses of dialogue, even in the new record, there's I mean, this is a minor thing, but it's lovely in Goodbye, Jimmy Reed, towards the end, when it goes, God be with you, brother dear, if you don't mind me asking, what brings you here? Just the kind of bounce of that language is just fantastic. Someone said, apparently someone has detected that God be with you, brother dear, comes from a Molière play. I don't know. Some of this may just be coincidence. Going back to where we started and talking about that waitress scene in Highlands, one of the other things that I loved about that was it shows that he was still listening, that he was still alert. He had his ear to the ground at that time, because the kind of language, that character, the waitress, does feel like a contemporary young woman. And that there's something that feels sort of crisp and real about that encounter. And, you know, on Together Through Life, which, you know, it's not a record I love, just because I find it sort of saturated in that accordion, and I sort of it just feels swamped with that. But that song, It's All Good, I remember not loving the song necessarily, but just loving the idea that he is writing a song about that very contemporary phrase that, you know, we hear all the time, and that he does wonderful ironic things with. And just again, that sense that he's still got his ear to the ground, he's still listening, he's still attuned to the kind of rhythms of vernacular demotic language, I think is something that's a pleasure.
Is It Rolling, Bob Talking Dylan is recorded on Zencaster, stuck inside Immobile,
engineered by Mark Langley Smith and produced by Robin Guise. Digital imaging by Finn Guise. Music is by Sam Hare.
We're part of Pantheon Podcasts, the music podcast network.
Find us on Twitter at IsItRollingPod.
Try to be pure at heart. They arrest you for robbery. Mistake your shyness for aloofness, your silence for snobbery. Got the message this morning, the one that was sent to me, about the madness of becoming what one was never meant to be.